39. The two rooms on the second floor of the house on the Piazza di Spagna are small, narrow, high-ceilinged, and, except for a single dim lamp burning in each room, as if lighted by ghosts in expectation of a visit by other ghosts, quite dark. My bed is in the smaller of the two rooms, the one facing the piazza. Although all one can see from the high windows this night is darkness, creased by deeper shadows and accented by the ceaseless burbling of Bernini's unseen fountain. Bells ring on the hour from one of the twin towers of Santa Trinità de' Monti, the church that crouches in the dark like a massive, tawny cat at the head of the stairs outside. And each time I hear the bells toll the brief notes of the early hours of the morn, I imagine ghostly hands pulling rotting bell ropes. Or perhaps rotting hands pulling ghostly bell ropes. I don't know which image suits my macabre fancies this endless night. Fever lies upon me this night, as dank and heavy and stifling as a thick, water-soaked blanket. My skin alternately burns and then is clammy to the touch. Twice I have been seized with coughing spasms. The first brought Hunt running in from his couch in the other room, and I watched his eyes widen at the sight of the blood I had vomited on the damask sheets. The second spasm I stifled as best I could, staggering to the basin on the bureau to spit up smaller quantities of black blood and dark phlegm. Hunt did not wake the second time. To be back here, to come all this way to these dark rooms, this grim bed. I half remember awakening here, miraculously cured, the real Severn and Dr. Clark, and even little Signora Angeletti, hovering in the outer room. That period of convalescence from death, that period of realization that I was not Keats, was not on the true earth, that this was not in the century I had closed my eyes in that last night, that I was not human. Sometime after two I sleep, and as I sleep I dream. The dream is one I have never suffered before. I dream that I rise slowly through the datum plane, through the datasphere, into and through the megasphere, and finally into a place I do not know, have never dreamt of. A place of infinite spaces, unhurried, indescribable colors. A place with no horizons, no ceilings, no floors or solid areas one might call the ground. I think of it as the metasphere, for I sense immediately that this level of consensual reality includes all of the varieties and vagaries of sensation which I have experienced on earth. All of the binary analyses and intellectual pleasures I have felt flowing from the technocore through the datasphere, and above all, a sense of what? Expansiveness? Freedom? Potential might be the word I am hunting for. I am alone in this metasphere. Colors flow above me, under me, through me. Sometimes dissolving into vague pastels, sometimes coalescing into cloud-like fantasies, and at other times, rarely, appearing to form into more solid objects, shapes, distinct forms which may or may not be humanoid in appearance. I watch them the way a child might watch clouds and imagine elephants, crocodiles from the Nile, and great gunboats marching from west to east on a spring day in the Lake District. After a while I hear sounds, the maddening trickle of the Bernini fountain in the piazza outside, doves rustling and cooing on the ledges above my window, Lee Hunt moaning softly in his sleep. But above and beneath these noises, I hear something more stealthy, less real, but infinitely more threatening. Something large this way comes. I strain to see through the pastel gloom. Something is moving just beyond the horizon of sight. I know that it knows my name. I know that it holds my life in one palm and death in its other fist. There is no place to hide in this space beyond space. I cannot run. The siren song of pain continues to rise and fall from the world I left behind. The everyday pain of each person everywhere. The pain of those suffering from the war just begun. The specific, focused pain of those on the Shrike's terrible tree, and worst of all, the pain I feel for and from the pilgrims and those others whose lives and thoughts I now share. It would be worth rushing to greet this approaching shadow of doom if it would grant me freedom from that song of pain. Severn! Severn! For a second, I think that I am the one calling, just as I had before in these rooms, calling Joseph Severn in the night when my pain and fever ranged beyond my ability to contain it. And he was always there. Severn. With his hulking, well-meaning slowness, and that gentle smile which I often wanted to wipe from his face with some small meanness or comment. It is hard to be good-natured when one is dying. I had led a life of some generosity. Why, then, was it my fate to continue that role when I was the one suffering, when I was the one coughing the ragged remnants of my lungs into stained handkerchiefs? Severn! It is not my voice. Hunt is shaking me by the shoulders, calling Severn's name. I realize that he thinks he is calling my name. I brush away his hands and sink back into the pillows. What is it? What's wrong? You are moaning, says Gladstone's aide, crying out. A nightmare, nothing more. Your dreams are usually more than dreams, says Hunt. He glances around the narrow room, illuminated now by the single lamp he has carried in. What a terrible place, Severn. I try to smile. It cost me 28 shillings a month. 7 scudi. Highway robbery. Hunt frowns at me. The stark light makes his wrinkles seem deeper than usual. Listen, Severn. I know you're a cybrid. Gladstone told me that you were the retrieval persona of a poet named Keats. Now, obviously, all this... He gestured helplessly toward the room, shadows, tall rectangle of windows and high bed. All this has something to do with that, but how? What game is the Corps playing here? I'm not sure, I say truthfully. But you know this place? Oh, yes, I say with feeling. Tell me... pleads Hunt, and it is his restraint to this point in not asking, as much as the earnestness of that plea now, which decides me to tell him. I tell him about the poet John Keats, about his birth in 1795, his short and frequently unhappy life, and about his death from consumption in 1821 in Rome, far from his friends and only love. I tell him about my staged recovery in this very room, about my decision to take the name of Joseph Severn, the artist acquaintance who stayed with Keats until his death. And finally, I tell him about my short time in the web, listening, watching, condemned to dream the lives of the Shrike pilgrims on Hyperion and the others. Dreams? Says Hunt. You mean even now you're dreaming about what's occurring in the web? Yes. I tell him of the dreams about Gladstone, the destruction of Heaven's Gate and God's Grove, and the confused images from Hyperion. Hunt is pacing back and forth in the narrow room, his shadow thrown high on the rough walls. Can you contact them? The ones I dream of? Gladstone? I think a second. No. Are you sure? I try to explain. I'm not even in these dreams, Hunt. I have no voice, no presence. There's no way I can contact those I dream about. But sometimes you dream what they're thinking. I realize that this is true, close to the truth. I sense what they are feeling. Then can't you leave some trace in their mind, in their memory? Let them know where we are. No. Hunt collapses into the chair at the foot of my bed. He suddenly seems very old. Lee, I say, Even if I could communicate with Gladstone or the others, which I can't, what good would it do? I've told you that this replica of old Earth is in the Magellanic Cloud. Even at quantum leap Hawking velocities, it would take centuries for anyone to reach us. We could warn them, says Hunt, his voice so tired that it sounds almost sullen. Warn them of what? All of Gladstone's worst nightmares are coming true around her. Do you think she trusts the Corps now? That's why the Corps could kidnap us so blatantly. Events are proceeding too quickly for Gladstone or anyone in the hegemony to deal with. Hunt rubs his eyes, then steeples his fingers under his nose. His stare is not overly friendly.
Are you really the retrieved personality of a poet?
I say nothing.
Recite some poetry. Make something up.
I shake my head. It is late. We're both tired and frightened, and my heart has not yet quit pounding from the nightmare which was more than a nightmare. I won't let Hunt make me angry.
Come on, he says. Show me that you're the new, improved version of Bill Keats.
John Keats, I say softly.
Whatever. Come on, Severn, or John, or whatever I should call you, recite some poesy.
All right, I said, returning his stare. Listen. There was a naughty boy, and a naughty boy was he, for nothing would he do but scribble poetry. He took an inkstand in his hand, and a pen, big as 10, in the other, and away. In a pother, he ran to the mountains and fountains and ghosts and posts and witches and ditches, and wrote in his coat when the weather was cool, fear of gout, and without when the weather was warm. Ach, the charm when we chose to follow one's nose to the north, to follow one's nose to the north.
I don't know, says Hunt. That doesn't sound like something a poet whose reputation has lasted 1,000 years would have written.
I shrug.
Were you dreaming about Gladstone tonight? Did something happen that caused those moans?
No, it wasn't about Gladstone. It was a real nightmare for a change. Hunt stands, lifts his lamp, and prepares to take the only light from the room. I can hear the fountain in the piazza. The doves on the window sills.
Tomorrow, he says, we'll make sense of all this and figure out a way to get back. If they can forecast us here, there must be a way to forecast home.
Yes, I say, knowing it is not true.
Good night, says Hunt. No more nightmares, all right?
No more, I say, knowing this is even less true. Moneta pulled the wounded Cassad away from the shrike and seemed to hold the creature at bay with an extended hand, while she fumbled a blue torus from the belt of her skin suit and twisted it behind her. A 2-meter-high gold oval hung burning in midair.
"Let me go," muttered Cassad. "Let us finish it."
There was blood spattered where the shrike had clawed huge rents in the colonel's skin suit. His right foot was dangling as if half-severed. He could put no weight on it, and only the fact that he had been struggling with the shrike, half-carried by the thing in a mad parody of a dance, had kept Cassad upright as they fought.
"Let me go," repeated Fedmon Cassad.
"Shut up," said Moneta, and then more softly, "Shut up, my love." She dragged him through the golden oval, and they emerged into blazing light. Even through his pain and exhaustion, Cassad was dazzled by the sight. They were not on Hyperion, he was sure of that. A vast plain stretched to an horizon much farther away than logic or experience would allow. Low orange grass, if grass it was, grew on the flatlands and low hills like fuzz on the back of some immense caterpillar, while things which might have been trees grew like whiskered carbon sculptures, their trunks and branches escherish in their baroque improbability, their leaves a riot of dark blue and violet ovals shimmering toward a sky alive with light. But not sunlight. Even as Moneta carried him away from the closing portal, Kassad did not think of it as a farcaster, since he felt sure it had carried them through time as well as space, and toward a copse of those impossible trees. Kassad turned his eyes toward the sky and felt something close to wonder. It was as bright as a Hyperion day, as bright as midday on a Lusian shopping mall, as bright as midsummer on the Tharsis plateau of Kassad's dry homeworld, Mars. But this was no sunlight. The sky was filled with stars and constellations and star clusters and a galaxy so cluttered with suns that there were almost no patches of darkness between the lights. It was like being in a planetarium with 10 projectors, thought Kassad. Like being at the center of the galaxy. The center of the galaxy. A group of men and women in skin suits moved out from the shade of the Escher trees to circle Kassad and Moneta. One of the men, a giant, even by Kassad's Martian standards, looked at him, raised his head toward Moneta, and even though Kassad could hear nothing, sense nothing on his skin suit's radio and tight band receivers, he knew the two were communicating. "Lie back," said Moneta, as she laid Kassad on the velvety orange grass. He struggled to sit up, to speak, but both she and the giant touched his chest with their palms, and he lay back so that his vision was filled with the slowly twisting violet leaves and the sky of stars. The man touched him again, and Kassad's skin suit was deactivated. He tried to sit up, tried to cover himself, as he realized he was naked before the small crowd that had gathered. But Moneta's firm hand held him in place. Through the pain and dislocation, he vaguely sensed the man touching his slashed arms and chest, running a silver-coated hand down his leg to where the Achilles tendon had been cut. The colonel felt a coolness wherever the giant touched, and then his consciousness floated away like a balloon, high above the tawny plain and the rolling hills, drifting toward the solid canopy of stars, where a huge figure waited, dark as a towering thundercloud above the horizon, massive as a mountain. "Kassad," whispered Moneta, and the colonel drifted back. "Kassad," she said again, her lips against his cheek, his skin suit reactivated and melted with hers. Colonel Fedmon Kassad sat up as she did. He shook his head, realized that he was clothed in quicksilver energy once again, and got to his feet. There was no pain. He felt his body tingle in a dozen places where injuries had been healed, serious cuts repaired. He melded his hand to his own suit, ran flesh across flesh, bent his knee and touched his heel, but could feel no scars. Kassad turned toward the giant.
"Thank you," he said,
not knowing if the man could hear. The giant nodded and stepped back toward the others.
"He's a doctor of sorts," said Moneta. "A healer."
Kassad half heard her as he concentrated on the other people. They were human. He knew in his heart that they were human, but the variety was staggering. Their skin suits were not all silver like Kassad's and Moneta's, but ranged through a score of colors, each as soft and organic as some living wild creature's pelt. Only the subtle energy shimmer and blurred facial features revealed the skin suit surface. Their anatomy was as varied as their coloration. The healer's shrike-sized girth and massive bulk, his massive brow and a cascade of tawny energy flow which might be a mane. A female next to him, no larger than a child, but obviously a woman, perfectly proportioned with muscular legs, small breasts, and fairy wings 2 meters long rising from her back. And not merely decorative wings either, for when the breeze ruffled the orange prairie grass, this woman gave a short run, extended her arms, and rose gracefully into the air. Behind several tall, thin women with blue skin suits and long webbed fingers, a group of short men were as visored and armor-plated as a force marine going into battle in a vacuum. But Kassad sensed that the armor was part of them. Overhead, a cluster of winged males rose on thermals, thin yellow beams of laser light pulsing between them in some complex code. The lasers seemed to emanate from an eye in each of their chests. Kassad shook his head again.
"We need to go," said Moneta. "The Shrike cannot follow us here. These warriors have enough to contend with without dealing with this particular manifestation of the Lord of Pain."
"Where are we?" asked Kassad.
Moneta brought a violet oval into existence with a golden ferrule from her belt.
"Far in humankind's future. One of our futures. This is where the time tombs were formed and launched backward in time."
Kassad looked around again. Something very large moved in front of the star field, blocking out thousands of stars and throwing a shadow for scant seconds before it was gone. The men and women looked up briefly and then went back to their business, harvesting small things from the trees, huddling in clusters to view bright energy maps called up by a flick of one man's fingers, flying off toward the horizon with the speed of a thrown spear. One low, round individual of indeterminate sex had burrowed into the soft soil and was visible now only as a faint line of raised earth moving in quick concentric circles around the band.
"Where is this place?"
Kassad asked again.
"What is it?"
Suddenly, inexplicably, he felt himself close to tears, as if he had turned an unfamiliar corner, and found himself at home in the Tharsis relocation projects, his long-dead mother waving to him from a doorway, his forgotten friends and siblings waiting for him to join a game of scootball.
"Come," said Moneta,
and there was no mistaking the urgency in her voice. She pulled Kassad toward the glowing oval. He watched the others and the dome of stars until he stepped through and the view was lost to sight. They stepped out into darkness, and it took the briefest of seconds for the filters in Kassad's skin suit to compensate his vision. They were at the base of the crystal monolith in the valley of the time tombs on Hyperion. It was night. Clouds boiled overhead, and a storm was raging. Only a pulsing glow from the tombs themselves illuminated the scene. Kassad felt a sick lurch of loss for the clean, well-lighted place they had just left, and then his mind focused on what he was seeing. Saul Weintraub and Braun Lamia were half a click down the valley, Saul bending over the woman as she lay near the front of the jade tomb. Wind swirled dust around them so thickly that they did not see the Shrike moving like another shadow down the trail past the obelisk toward them. Fedman Kassad stepped off the dark marble in front of the monolith and skirted the shattered crystal shards which littered the path. He realized that Moneta still clung to his arm.
"If you fight again," she said, her voice soft and urgent in his ear, "the Shrike will kill you."
"They're my friends," said Kassad.
His force gear and torn armor lay where Moneta had thrown it hours earlier. He searched the monolith until he found his assault rifle and a bandolier of grenades, saw the rifle was still functional, checked charges and clicked off safeties, left the monolith, and stepped forward at double time to intercept the Shrike. I wake to the sound of water flowing, and for a second I believe I am awakening from my nap near the waterfall of Lodore during my walking tour with Brown. But the darkness when I open my eyes is as fearsome as when I slept. The water has a sick, trickling sound, rather than the rush of the cataract which Southey would someday make famous in his poem. And I feel terrible, not merely sick with the sore throat I came down with on our tour after Brown and I foolishly climbed Skiddaw before breakfast, but mortally, fearfully ill, with my body aching with something deeper than ague, while phlegm and fire bubble in my chest and belly. I rise and feel my way to the window by touch. A dim light comes under the door from Lee Hunt's room, and I realize that he has gone to sleep with the lamp still lit. That would not have been a bad thing for me to have done, but it is too late to light it now as I feel my way to the lighter rectangle of outer darkness set into the deeper darkness of the room. The air is fresh and filled with the scent of rain. I realize that the sound that woke me is thunder, as lightning flashes over the rooftops of Rome. No lights burn in the city. By leaning slightly out of the open window, I can see the stairs above the piazza all slick with rain, and the towers of Trinità dei Monti outlined blackly against lightning flashes. The wind that blows down those steps is chill, and I move back to the bed to pull a blanket around me before dragging a chair to the window and sitting there, looking out, thinking. I remember my brother Tom during those last weeks and days, his face and body contorted with the terrible effort to breathe. I remember my mother and how pale she looked, her face almost shining in the gloom of the darkened room. My sister and I were allowed to touch her clammy hand, kiss her fevered lips, and then withdraw. I remember that once I furtively wiped my lips as I left that room, glancing sideways to see if my sister or others had seen my sinful act. When Dr. Clark and an Italian surgeon opened Keats's body less than 30 hours after he had died, they found, as Severn later wrote a friend, the worst possible consumption. The lungs were entirely destroyed, the cells were quite gone. Neither Dr. Clark nor the Italian surgeon could imagine how Keats had lived those last 2 months or more. I think of this as I sit in the darkened room and look out on the darkened piazza, all the while listening to the boiling in my chest and throat, feeling the pain like fire inside and the worst pain from the cries in my mind. Cries from Martin Silenus on the tree, suffering for writing the poetry I had been too frail and cowardly to finish. Cries from Phedmon Cassad as he prepares to die at the claws of the shrike. Cries from the consul as he is forced into betrayal a second time. Cries from thousands of Templar throats as they bewail the death of both their world and their brother Hetmastine. Cries from Braun Lamia as she thinks of her dead lover, my twin. Cries from Paul Duret as he lies fighting burns in the shock of memory, all too aware of the waiting cruciforms on his chest. Cries from Saul Weintraub as he beats his fist on the earth of Hyperion, calling for his child. The infant cries of Rachel still in our ears. God damn, I say softly, beating my fist against the stone and mortar of the window frame. God damn. After a while, just as the first hint of paleness promises dawn, I move away from the window, find my bed, and lie down just a moment to close my eyes. Governor General Theo Lane awoke to the sound of music. He blinked and looked around, recognizing the nearby nutrient tank and ship surgery as if from a dream. Theo realized that he was wearing soft black pajamas and had been sleeping on the surgery's examination couch. The past 12 hours began to stitch themselves together from Theo's patches of memory, being raised from the treatment tank, sensors being applied, the consul and another man leaning over him, asking him questions. Theo answering just as if he were truly conscious. Then sleep again, dreams of Hyperion and its cities burning. No. Not dreams. Theo sat up, felt himself almost float off the couch, found his clothes cleaned and folded neatly on a nearby shelf, and dressed quickly, hearing the music continue, now rising, now fading, but always continuing with a haunting acoustical quality which suggested that it was live and not recorded. Theo took the short stairway to the recreation deck and stopped in surprise as he realized that the ship was open, the balcony extended, the containment field apparently off. Gravity underfoot was minimal, enough to pull Theo back to the deck, but little more, probably 20% or less of Hyperions, perhaps 1/6 standard. The ship was open. Brilliant sunlight streamed in the open door to the balcony, where the consul sat playing the antique instrument he had called a piano. Theo recognized the archaeologist, Arendez, leaning against the hull opening with a drink in his hand. The consul was playing something very old and very complicated. His hands were a studied blur on the keyboard. Theo moved closer, started to whisper something to the smiling Arendez, and then stopped in shock to stare. Beyond the balcony, 30 meters below, brilliant sunlight fell on a bright green lawn stretching to an horizon far too close. On that lawn, clusters of people sat and lay in relaxed postures, obviously listening to the consul's impromptu concert. But what people? Theo could see tall, thin people, looking like the aesthetes of Epsilon Eridani, pale and bald in their wispy blue robes. But beside them and beyond them an amazing multitude of human types sat listening. More varieties than the web had ever seen. Humans cloaked in fur and scales. Humans with bodies like bees and eyes to match, multifaceted receptors and antennae. Humans as fragile and thin as wire sculptures, great black wings extending from their thin shoulders and folding around them like capes. Humans apparently designed for massive G-worlds, short and stout and muscular as Cape Buffalo, making Lusians look fragile in comparison. Humans with short bodies and long arms covered with orange fur, only their pale and sensitive faces separating them from some hollow of old Earth's long-extinct orangutans. And other humans, looking more lemur than humanoid, more aquiline or leonine or ursine or anthropoid than manlike. Yet somehow, Theo knew at once that these were human beings, as shocking as their differences were. Their attentive gazes, their relaxed postures, and 100 other subtle human attributes, down to the way a butterfly-winged mother cradled a butterfly-winged child in her arms, all gave testimony to a common humanity which Theo could not deny. Milio Arendez turned, smiled at Theo's expression, and whispered, "Osters." Stunned, Theo Lane could do little more than shake his head and listen to the music. Austers were barbarians, not these beautiful and sometimes ethereal creatures. Auster captives on Brescia, not to mention the bodies of their infantry dead, had been of a uniform body sort. Tall, yes, thin, yes, but decidedly more web standard than this dizzying display of variety. Theo shook his head again as the consul's piano piece rose to a crescendo and ended on a definitive note. The hundreds of beings in the field beyond applauded, the sound high and soft in the thin air. And then Theo watched as they stood, stretched, and headed different ways, some walking quickly over the disturbingly near horizon, others unfolding 8-meter wings and flying away. Still others moved toward the base of the consul's ship. The consul stood, saw Theo, and smiled. He clapped the younger man on the shoulder. "Theo, just in time. We'll be negotiating soon." Theo Lane blinked. 3 Austers landed on the balcony and folded their great wings behind them. Each of the men was heavily furred and differently marked and striped, their pelts as organic and convincing as any wild creature's.
"As delightful as always," the closest Auster said to the consul.
The Auster's face was leonine, broad nose and golden eyes framed by a ruff of tawny fur.
"The last piece was Mozart's Fantasia in D minor, KV-397, was it not?"
"It was," said the consul. "Freeman Vance, I would like to introduce M. Theo Lane, Governor-General of the Hegemony Protectorate World of Hyperion." The lion gaze turned on Theo.
"An honor,"
said Freeman Vance, and extended a furred hand. Theo shook it.
"A pleasure to meet you, sir."
Theo wondered if he were actually still in the recovery tank, dreaming this. The sunlight on his face and the firm palm against his suggested otherwise. Freeman Vance turned back to the consul.
On behalf of the aggregate, I thank you for that concert. It has been too many years since we have heard you play, my friend.
He glanced around.
We can hold the talks here, or at one of the administrative compounds at your convenience.
The consul hesitated only a second. There are three of us, Freeman Vance. Many of you. We will join you. The lion head nodded and glanced skyward.
We will send a boat for your crossing.
He and the other two moved to the railing and stepped off, falling several meters before unfurling their complex wings and flying toward the horizon.
Jesus, whispered Theo.
He gripped the consul's forearm.
Where are we?
The swarm, said the consul, covering the Steinway's keyboard. He led the way inside, waited for Arendez to step back, and then brought the balcony in.
And what are we going to negotiate? Asked Theo.
The consul rubbed his eyes. It looked as if the man had slept little or not at all during the 10 or 12 hours Theo had been healing. That depends upon CEO Gladstone's next message, said the consul, and nodded toward where the hollow pit misted with transmission columns. A fat line squirt was being decoded on the ship's one-time pad at that moment. Mayna Gladstone stepped into the Government House infirmary and was escorted by waiting doctors to the recovery bay where Father Paul Duret lay.
How is he?
She asked the first doctor, the CEO's own physician.
Second-degree flash burns over about a third of his body, answered Dr. Irma Andraneva. He lost his eyebrows and some hair. He didn't have that much to start with, and there were some tertiary radiation burns on the left side of his face and body. We've completed the epidermal regeneration and given RNA template injections. He's in no pain and conscious. There is the problem of the cruciform parasites in his chest, but that is of no immediate danger to the patient.
Tertiary radiation burns, said Gladstone, stopping for a moment just out of earshot of the cubicle where Duret waited. Plasma bombs?
Yes, answered another doctor, whom Gladstone did not recognize. We're certain that this man cast in from God's Grove a second or two before the Farcaster connection was cut.
All right, said Gladstone, stopping by the floating pallet where Duret rested. I wish to speak to the gentleman alone, please. The doctors glanced at one another, waved a mech nurse to its wall storage, and closed the portal to the ward room as they departed. Father Duret? Asked Gladstone, recognizing the priest from his hollows and Severn's descriptions during the pilgrimage. Duret's face was red and mottled now, and it glistened from regeneration gel and spray-on painkiller. He was still a man of striking appearance.
CEO,
whispered the priest, and made as if to sit up. Gladstone set a gentle hand on his shoulder. Rest, she said. Do you feel like telling me what happened? Duret nodded. There were tears in the old Jesuit's eyes.
The true voice of the World Tree didn't believe that they would really attack,
he whispered, his voice raw.
Sekhardin thought that the Templars had some pact with the Ousters, some arrangement. But they did attack. Tactical lances. Plasma devices, nuclear explosives, I think.
Yes, said Gladstone. We monitored it from the war room. I need to know everything, Father Duret. Everything from the point when you stepped into the cave tomb on Hyperion. Paul Duret's eyes focused on Gladstone's face.
You know about that?
Yes. And about most other things to that point. But I need to know more. Much more. Duret closed his eyes.
The labyrinth.
What?
The labyrinth,
he said again, voice stronger. He cleared his throat and told her about his voyage through the tunnels of corpses, the transition to a force ship, and his meeting with Severn on Pachem. And you're sure Severn was headed here, to Government House? Asked Gladstone.
Yes. He and your aide, Hunt. Both of them intended to cast here.
Gladstone nodded and carefully touched an unburned section of the priest's shoulder. Father, things are happening very quickly here.
Severn is missing, and so is Leigh Hunt. I need advice about Hyperion. Will you stay with me? Duray looked confused for a moment.
I need to get back. Back to Hyperion, I'm executive. Saul and the others are waiting for me.
I understand, said Gladstone soothingly. As soon as there's a way back to Hyperion, I'll expedite your return. Right now, however, the web is under brutal attack. Millions are dying or in danger of dying. I need your help, Father. Can I count on you until then? Paul Duray sighed and lay back.
Yes, I'm executive. But I have no idea how I...
There was a soft knock, and Sedeptra Akasi entered and handed Gladstone a message, Flimsy. The CEO smiled. I said that things were happening quickly, Father. Here's another development. A message from Pacham says that the College of Cardinals has met in the Sistine Chapel. Gladstone raised an eyebrow. I forget, Father. Is that the Sistine Chapel?
Yes. The church took it apart stone by stone, fresco by fresco, and moved it to Pacham after the big mistake.
Gladstone looked down at the Flimsy. Met in the Sistine Chapel and elected a new pontiff.
So soon?
Whispered Paul Duray. He closed his eyes again.
I guess they felt they must hurry. Pacham lies, what, only 10 days in front of the Auster invasion wave? Still, to come to a decision so quickly.
Are you interested in who the new pope is? Asked Gladstone.
Either Antonio Cardinal Guarducci or Agostino Cardinal Rudel, I would guess, said Duray. None of the others would command a majority at this time.
No, said Gladstone. According to this message from Bishop Edward of the Curia Romana...
Bishop Edward? Excuse me, I'm executive. Please go on.
According to Bishop Edward, the College of Cardinals has elected someone below the rank of Monsignor for the first time in the history of the Church. This says that the new pope is a Jesuit priest, a certain Father Paul Duray. Duray sat straight up despite his burns.
What?
There was no belief in his voice. Gladstone handed the Flimsy to him. Paul Duray stared at the paper.
This is impossible. They have never elected a pontiff below the rank of Monsignor, except symbolically, and that was unique. It was St. Belvedere after the big mistake and the miracle of the... No, this is impossible.
Bishop Edward has been trying to call, according to my aid, said Gladstone. We'll have the call put through here at once, Father. Or, should I say, Your Holiness. There was no irony in the CEO's voice. Duray looked up, too stunned to speak. I will have the call put through, said Gladstone. We'll arrange your return to Pacham as quickly as possible, Your Holiness, but I would appreciate it if you could keep in touch. I do need your advice. Duray nodded and looked back at the Flimsy. A phone began to blink on the console above the pallet. CEO Gladstone stepped out into the hall, told the doctors about the most recent development, contacted security to approve the Farcast clearance for Bishop Edward or other church officials from Pacham, and cast back to her room in the residential wing. Sedeptra reminded her that the council was reconvening in the war room in 8 minutes. Gladstone nodded, saw her aide out, and stepped back to the Fatline cubicle in its concealed niche in the wall. She activated sonic privacy fields and coded the transmission disk key for the console's ship. Every Fatline receiver in the web, outback, galaxy, and universe would monitor the squirt, but only the console's ship could decode it. Or so she hoped. The holocamera light winked red. Based on the automated squirt from your ship, I am assuming that you chose to meet with the Austers, and they have allowed you to do so. Gladstone said into the camera. I am also assuming that you survived the initial meeting. Gladstone took a breath. On behalf of the hegemony, I have asked you to sacrifice much over the years. Now I ask you on behalf of all of humankind. You must find out the following. First, why are the Austers attacking and destroying the worlds of the web? You were convinced. Byron Lamia was convinced, and I was convinced, that they wanted only Hyperion. Why have they changed this? Second, where is the Technocore? I must know if we are to fight them. Have the Ousters forgotten our common enemy, the Core? Third, what are their demands for a ceasefire? I am willing to sacrifice much to rid us of the Core's domination, but the killing must stop. Fourth, would the leader of the Swarm Aggregate be willing to meet with me in person? I will forecast to Hyperion's system if this is necessary. Most of our fleet elements have left there, but a jump ship and its escort craft remain with the Singularity Sphere. The Swarm leader must decide soon, because Force wants to destroy the Sphere, and Hyperion then will be 3 years' time debt from the Web. Finally, the Swarm leader must know that the Core wishes us to use a form of Deathbond explosive device to counter the Ouster invasion. Many of the Force leaders agree. Time is short. We will not, repeat not, allow the Ouster invasion to overrun the Web. It is up to you now. Please acknowledge this message and fatline me as soon as negotiations have begun. Gladstone looked into the camera disc, willing the force of her personality and sincerity across the light-years. I beseech you, in the bowels of humankind's history, please accomplish this. The fat-line message squirt was followed by 2 minutes of jerky imagery, showing the deaths of Heaven's Gate and God's Grove. The consul, Melio Arendez, and Theo Lane sat in silence after the hollows faded. Response? Queried the ship. The consul cleared his throat. Acknowledge message received, he said. Send our coordinates. He looked across the hollow pit at the other two. Gentlemen? Arendez shook his head as if clearing it.
It's obvious you've been here before, to the Ouster Swarm.
Yes, said the consul. After Brescia. After my wife and son. After Brescia, some time ago. I rendezvoused with this swarm for extensive negotiations.
Representing the hegemony?
Asked Theo. The redhead's face looked much older and lined with worry.
Representing Senator Gladstone's faction, said the consul. It was before she was first elected CEO.
Her group explained to me that an internal power struggle within the Technocore could be affected by our bringing Hyperion into the Web Protectorate. The easiest way to do that was to allow information to slip to the Ousters. Information that would cause them to attack Hyperion, thus bringing the hegemony fleet here.
And you did that.
Arendez's voice showed no emotion, although his wife and grown children lived on Renaissance Vector, now less than 80 hours away from the invasion wave. The consul sat back in the cushions. No, I told the Ousters about the plan. They sent me back to the Web as a double agent. They planned to seize Hyperion, but at a time of their own choosing. Theo sat forward, his hands clasped very tightly.
All those years at the consulate.
I was waiting for word from the Ousters, the consul said flatly. You see, they had a device that would collapse the anti-entropic fields around the time tombs. Open them when they were ready. Allow the Shrike to slip its bonds.
So the Ousters did that, said Theo.
No, said the consul. I did. I betrayed the Ousters just as I betrayed Gladstone and the hegemony. I shot the Ouster woman who was calibrating the device, her and the technicians with her, and turned it on. The anti-entropic fields collapsed. The final pilgrimage was arranged. The Shrike is free. Theo stared at his former mentor. There was more puzzlement than rage in the younger man's green eyes.
Why? Why did you do all this?
The consul told them, briefly and dispassionately, about his grandmother Siri of Maui Covenant, and about her rebellion against the hegemony, a rebellion which did not die when she and her lover, the consul's grandfather, died. Arendez rose from the pit and walked to the window opposite the balcony. Sunlight streamed across his legs in the dark blue carpet.
Do the Ousters know what you did?
They do now, said the consul. I told Freeman Vance and the others when we arrived. Theo paced the diameter of the hollow pit.
"So this meeting we're going to might be a trial?"
The consul smiled.
"Or an execution."
Theo stopped, both hands clenched in fists.
"And Gladstone knew this when she asked you to come here again?"
"Yes."
Theo turned away.
"I don't know whether I want them to execute you or not."
"I don't know either, Theo," said the consul. Emilio Arendez turned away from the window.
"Didn't Vance say they were sending a boat to fetch us?"
Something in his tone brought the other two men to the window. The world where they had landed was a middle-sized asteroid which had been encircled by a Class 10 containment field and terraformed into a sphere by generations of wind and water and careful restructuring. Hyperion sun was setting behind the too near horizon, and the few kilometers of featureless grass rippled to a vagrant breeze. Below the ship, a wide stream or narrow river ambled across the pasture land, approached the horizon, and then seemed to fly upward into a river-turned waterfall, twisting up through the distant containment field and winding through the blackness of space above before dwindling to a line too narrow to see. A boat was descending that infinitely tall waterfall, approaching the surface of their small world. Humanoid figures could be seen near the bow and stern.
"Christ," whispered Theo.
"We'd best get ready," said the consul. "That's our escort." Outside, the sun set with shocking rapidity, sending its last rays through the curtain of water half a kilometer above the shadowed ground, and searing the ultramarine sky with rainbows of almost frightening color and solidity.